This is Susie Asher, Depth, Psychology, and Art, Henry James, April 13, 1991, Tape 2 of 2.
When the Juno is discovered, the husband and wife are both asleep. The Count is awakened by a dream, quote, that they found a wonderful Juno and that she rose and came and laid her marble hand on mine. The statue actually has been discovered with the hand broken off. Now, the Countess sleeps at the same time, but James says, dreamlessly it appeared. Interesting. Synchronistically, the Count has the dream at the time the statue is discovered. The Countess is dreamless in her sleep. Jungians would play around with this coincidence, this synchronicity. And if we apply Jung's theory of the psychoid layer of or in the unconscious, then what the synchronicity would tell us or suggest is that the Count's ego is more vulnerable or permeable to the invasion of the deeply buried contents of the psyche. That the psychoid layer has to do with that archetypal stuff that comes up to consciousness. At that point at which it breaks through is where we have synchronicities. And so when the dream and the synchronicity of the finding of the statue happens at the same time, the Count is at that permeable membrane between those two realities. And he is more permeable to that stuff coming through. That's how a literary critic would use that theory applied to this evidence. We can find more evidence in the story later on that will support that. But at this point in the story, it says, well, look, we can hypothesize. He has the dream synchronistically at the time the statue is discovered. He's likely to be more permeable to invasion of that stuff. She doesn't dream at that point. Perhaps her ego boundaries are firmer in some way. Now, we don't know if they're too firm, but we know that at least they're not quite as permeable or open. We are dealing with literature which is itself symbolic. And I'm saying, this happens in the text. This is one way we could interpret it. Now, of course, the interpretation is not worth much unless it leads us further on in the story, and that's what we have to see. But at this point, I'm letting it serve as a hypothesis to the fact that the Count might be more easily overwhelmed than the Countess. Do you follow how I'm working with the material as a sleuth? Is that a question that you're on the edge of?
Or maybe all you can say is that she's not permanent with this stuff.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's the question we're raising. Is she as permeable as the Count to this very stuff that's coming up? You're right. She may be permeable. Yes, Michael.
Yeah, the one that's going in and puts it in there, and I'm not having a better alternative. The Count plays the character of the Count, but now the actor, and the genial, up until the point where he talks about letting him lie.
Mm-hmm. The statues, right, right.
And what I got out of that was he kind of opened himself up to be susceptible to whatever, you know, kind of from self-aware issue.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
I'm not going to say it's wrong or right, but I'm not going to say it.
He says, don't stir up the earth. Don't bring these statues to life. If you do, I'm not going to hold. I can't be responsible. He's warning them that he has a connection to this primitive stuff that he has kept buried in a way, because if it comes out, he says he can't be held responsible for what's going to come out. He pays his honor, so to speak, to the potency of what's there. And he pays homage to what... honor to the potency of what's buried by saying, don't bring it out or I can't be held responsible for my wits. It's potent stuff. And he's told us at other times in the story, I'm a poor Christian, I'm a good pagan, I never learned my catechisms, don't stir things up. And yet, when it comes out, there's no question that he is drawn toward it, which makes it wise of him to have said, you know, don't mess around, this is dangerous stuff. What happens when the statue comes out is he immediately pours a libation, puts the Juno in this garden house, starts to go at night in the moonlight to attend to her, to worship her, to lie prostrate before her. He becomes more moody, more distanced from his wife. They are depicted as being in love with great caresses, like a poet and a poetess in a bucolic poem. So, you know, they've had this very cuddly sexual experience, and now he won't touch his wife. So he's really gone overboard in this relationship. Let's see. Soon, James tells us, the Count begins to treat Juno, quote, as if she were a sacrosanct image of the Madonna, and keeps her hand like a relic in a silver box. The Count's pagan worship becomes an obsession. Whatever mystery, that's a term James uses, holds sway over the Count. Something is drawing him that he doesn't understand, that he's warned his wife about, and yet is clearly pulling him out of the marriage, the day-to-day reality, into this night moonlight world of obsession and worship. Finally, the Countess declares, his Juno is the reality, I am the fiction. So there's been kind of a reversal between the symbolic and the flesh and blood. As Michael mentioned, from the beginning, the Count acknowledges his affinities to paganism, his respect for what lies deeply buried. The Count is also quite dissatisfied with contemporary religion. There's a wonderful scene in which he describes the modern worshiper. He longs, this is the Count, longs for a faith that was on terms of reciprocity with nature. And he betrays his belief in the gods, old gods, continual presence. This is what I'm quoting. This is now the Count speaking. It was in the caves and woods and streams, in earth and air and water they dwelt, meaning the old gods. And there and here too, in spite of all your Christian lustrations, a son of old Italy may find them still. Now the narrator says, he, meaning the Count, had said more than he meant, and his mask had fallen. So what's being revealed is the Count really has a very strong pagan belief that these gods are potent. If I touch them, I am in touch with them, that the gods can still be found out in nature in the woods. So we have a contrast between an old faith, an animated world, and a modern Christian superficial tourist book, guides looking at the church, you know, candle lighting faith, which is nothing, which lacks all of this old passion. So that dichotomy is set up in the story very, very clearly. The picturesque, the old villa, is what attracts the narrator. He's painting pictures all the time of what is on the surface and picturesque. But the Count is not satisfied with the surface, with the picturesque. And James associates the Count with three gods: Dionysus, Lord of Souls, Hermes, the Guide of Souls, and Pan, James Hillman tells us, whose instinct is always in search of soul. So already the mythological associations connected to the Count are telling us that he's on a much deeper path, that he's soul hungry. He's in search of something that somehow the modern world has not given him. He had held it back by not playing around with this buried stuff. But the wife had come into his world, not only married him, but actually brought something out of the earth. She didn't know what she was bringing out. It's interesting that the other characters, the Countess and the narrator, are associated with another set of gods and goddesses. When the Count says to them, let them lie, meaning the statues, the poor disinherited gods, the Minerva, the Apollo, the Circe, you are so sure of finding. So we have two sets of gods, one associated with the Count, Hermes, Dionysus, Pan, and another set of gods, goddesses, associated with the Countess, the narrator, Apollo, Circe, Minerva. So, Apollo, Circe, god of grain, goddess of grain, Minerva, who's Athena. So you have on one hand Athena, Apollo, and Circe are gods and goddesses of order, of the natural cycle of things. Athena of crafts and wisdom and balance, Apollo we talked about last night, order, form, beauty, all of those kind of ordering natures, and distance, and certainly culture. I'm not saying bad things at all, but Hermes, Pan, and Dionysus are the disturbing gods, the ones who disrupt, who play tricks, who cross borders. And all these gods are paradoxical. I'm not saying they're positive and negative. But you certainly have a set of gods that, in connection with the soul, are also connected with things which are involved with upheaval. And the other sets of gods and goddesses with the Count and the Godfather that are associated with ordering, keeping things in cycles. Dionysus brings on madness. He's also the loosener. Wine provides release as well as intoxication and ecstasy. This is all the letting go stuff. Dionysus is also the twice-born god. The fullness in life as well as the violence of death are equally terrible in Dionysus. Otto talks about him as the most terrible of gods, the extremes being torn apart. Pan induces nightmares and panic. He also brings healing dreams. He creates a heightened sensitivity to nature and instinct, which Hillman reminds us can lead to insight. Fear can be a call to consciousness. So Pan works with dreams, heightened instinct, nature, call to consciousness, but possibly through fear and panic, not the usual ways that Apollo would bring. But Pan is associated with all those things. I'm quoting now Hillman, particularly his essay on Pan. Pan and Panic and Nightmares. He has a little book he calls Pan and the Nightmare, where Hillman has an essay and then he quotes another scholar. Hermes, of course, is the trickster and the thief. He's also the god of connections, bridging realms. The Herms are markers of boundaries and borders between earth and the underworld, man and gods, life and death. Hermes is the maker of mischief and of magic and the guardian of liminal space. These are rich associations for the Count. Hermes is the transition. Doorways and thresholds. The Herms that mark, you know, the marker, the stone markers outside, often marked potent spots. Well, the Hermetic, you know, the process of interpreting is very much the psyche's process. So Hermes and the Hermetic and the transcendent function and the interpretation of the psyche all get clustered together. The transformation of things in the transcendent process. Is that what you were thinking of?
Yeah.
Pardon me? Mm-hmm. So these associations of James with these three gods and the Count connects the Count to their attributes: depth, complexity, paradox, longing, passion, confusion, disruption, in the service of the soul. But the gods that the Count associates with his wife and the narrator represent more forms of order, restraint, balance, the regular cycles of things. See how richly loaded the story is, just with a few names being thrown out? Now, the Count, I mentioned, cannot mediate the goddess's demands. He cannot live with Juno and his wife at the same time. Literally, when she's unearthed, he worships the statue and separates himself from his wife. Given the choice with the Juno unearthed and his wife there, the Count falls into the worship of Juno. When Juno is buried, the Count returns to his wife. You're talking about the Count's passivity. It's as if the stronger force at the time pulls him. When that force is unearthed, he's pulled toward the Juno. When it's buried, he falls back to his wife. Now, James's narrator would agree with Adele's interpretation of the story. It's best to leave the past buried. And one might say, with a weak enough ego and no guide, no analyst, no help, that you might not want to unearth too much for that kind of ego, because it may mean losing any kind of control. There is a danger to being overwhelmed by the contents of the unconscious. I mean, that's why there's psychosis, right, and other kinds of serious mental illness. The narrator, who's afraid of this stuff too, remember, he's more interested in the picturesque surface, would certainly support Adele's interpretation of the story. But what I'm suggesting is the story itself, whether this is conscious in James or not, suggests another interpretation of the story. That is, the Count's soul hunger is pulling him to something that his life did not satisfy. There's an unanswered need that the story is demonstrating, even if the way he satisfies that need is out of proportion or out of control. And the value of what is in that Juno is somewhat suggested by this excavator, whom we said was a dwarfish, ugly man, an earthy gnome of the underworld, a subterranean genius. He's also identified as adept, expert, deft. He's a good excavator, even though the narrator doesn't like him. He's certainly accomplished in what he's done. But not only does he get the job done, that is the excavation, but his intuitions are also confirmed. He senses that, he seemed to hint, the narrator tells us, that excavations were sometimes a snare. And in fact, that's what the Count's experience tells us. He was snared. The excavator believed the Count had taken Juno's broken hand because they can't find it after the statue's unearthed. And in fact, the Count had taken it and had put it in a silver box as a relic. The excavator had expected that the Count would begin to say his prayers to the statue, and he does. Of all the characters in the story, it's really the excavator who has the best beat on the Count. Now, this dwarfish man states what I take to be the moral of the tale, and this is where in this, my reading is a new one. The excavator says, "I have fumbled so long in the monstrous heritage of antiquity that I have learned a multitude of secrets, learned that ancient relics may work modern miracles. There is a pagan element in us all, and the old gods still have their worshipers." So the excavator is saying we all have that pagan part of us, that soul-hungry part, and there are worshipers of the old ways still around. From a psychological point of view, we are pagans. Hillman talks about this. There's that wonderful book on polytheism. Because our personalities are composed of many inner gods contending for power. Calling these inner forces gods rather than complexes, for example, Stassinopoulos says, acknowledges their emotional power over us and our need to propitiate them, to attend to them, to give them conscious recognition, because if we do not, they rise up and take their revenge. Stassinopoulos, Stassinopoulos. This is a woman. This is a wonderful book. Ariane Stassinopoulos and Roloff Benny, The Gods of Greece. It's an oversized book. Benny is the photographer. It's New York Abrams Publication, 1983. It's one of the most delightful books about the Greek gods and goddesses. She is Greek. She and her sister, both beautiful women, did a presentation at Pacifica not long ago. They're wonderful speakers. She wrote a very exciting biography of Picasso. She's a prolific, very fine writer. And she has in the description of the Greek gods just beautiful, very psychologically astute descriptions. So I recommend that book tremendously.
So she's speaking more?
Yes. No, she's... No, this is her. But Hillman is saying the same things. He's... I can give you the... Pardon me? Her name? Oh, The Gods of the Greeks. Of Greece, I'm sorry. It's The Gods of Greece, and you spell her name Stassinopoulos. Ariana, Ariana. Now, Hillman says, and from Revisioning Psychology, page 14 of the preface with the Roman numerals, he says, our psychology is to begin with polytheistic, less out of religious confession than out of psychological necessity. The many-sidedness of human nature, the variety of viewpoints even within a single individual, requires the broadest possible spectrum of basic structures. They're arguing the same point. The pantheon provides us with many more variations than a single god or a monotheistic approach. And this ties into what the excavator is saying, is that there's a pagan in us all. So I'm just picking up the contemporary psychological meaning of what that is. Now, James provides another clue to the importance of the excavator when he identifies him with dwarves. Do you have association to dwarves? What are they? Yes. My son would like you very much. Right. Yes, go for it. My son says they make the best swords.
They were the miners. They lived underground. They dealt with the solid matter of the earth.
Right. And they brought up the gold from the earth. Right. Exactly. Any other? Yes. Yes. Any other association to dwarves?
Well, actually, I think it's Yoda.
Mm-hmm. Wise. Pardon me? Exactly. Exactly. I mean, these are all the mythological associations. That's why they're so good as books and films. Dwarves are wise in matters of the seasons and of the soil. Their kinship to the earth makes them naturally adept excavators. In Teutonic mythology, they lived in secret places, usually underground, were endowed with supernatural intelligence and foresight. They were the ones who mined and craft the earth's gold, make the best swords, my son would say, who are the rightful owners of buried treasure. They are naturally the symbol, von Frantz says, of the creative power of the unconscious. And they are also, Cast says, the creative companions of the Great Mother. They're loaded with positive associations. Verena Cast in her book on relationships. Well, von Franz says in a wonderful place that if you look at the dwarves, about 99% of them are good guys, but there are some dwarves who are not so kind. Yes, there are a few who are wicked, but percentage-wise, they mostly have good associations. Von Franz in The Feminine and Fairy Tales deals with dwarves a lot. So you have the Juno figure brought up, unearthed by a dwarfish character who carries all these associations. The Valerian Juno is then associated, I think, with the creative unconscious through her connection with this dwarfish earthy gnome of the underworld. She is, this is the Juno now, the statue, also associated with the overwhelming unmediated forces of the unconscious because she is the focus of the Count's obsession. So she gets it both ways, typical of the archetype, with both potentials there for the destructive and the creative, for the transformative and the overwhelming. Like all archetypes, Juno is an ambivalent figure. She represents both the potentially destructive and the potentially creative energies. See how loaded the story is? In the Aeneid, Virgil has Juno pay tribute to the power of the unconscious when she threatens, "If I cannot move heaven, I will stir up the underworld." Now, you find this line as the motto of Freud's interpretation of dreams. Because Freud is also paying tribute to the power and potency of the unconscious. Now, this is what Bruno Bettelheim says of that association. In Virgil's poem, Juno speaks these words in desperation, threatening to go to the underworld, because she has failed to get help from the gods and thus must seek it from the infernal regions. From a Freudian perspective, Juno's utterance suggests that if the superior world, our conscious mind, Bettelheim says, refuses to respond to the unconscious, then the underworld of the unconscious will shake up the superior world. This is exactly what's happening in the story. The conscious characters have not been paying heed to the unconscious. Juno gets brought up and all this stuff gets stirred up. Juno creates that kind of stir in the Count's life because we've had this extreme either-or, bury or bring out. And as I mentioned, the story has no middle ground. In the language of James's text, Juno is a resurgent goddess, a magnificent marble image, a masterpiece of skill, a marvel of presentation. Her finished beauty gave her an almost human look. Now, these descriptions are coming from the countess and the narrator. There's no question in the story that this statue moves them as well, that they are moved by her. The countess, in first meeting the statue, has tears in her eyes. The beautiful image stood bathed in a radiant flood and shining with a purity which made her almost persuasively divine. If by day her mellow complexion suggested faded gold, her substance now might have passed for polished silver. The effect was almost terrible. Beauty so eloquent could hardly be inanimate. This is the narrator speaking of the statue. James associates the Juno then with the deep, the dark, the repressed, the pagan, the archaic past, with moonlight, celestial supremacy and repose, with blood sacrifice, the count offers some kind of blood sacrifice, with withdrawal, the count's own withdrawal, his own obsession, his own possession, also with the beauty, with the artistic quality of the image, with image itself, with the unconscious through the associations to the dwarf and what's buried, to the disruptive, also to the transpersonal, because we're dealing with an image of the divine, and also with the search for soul. Now, that's a loaded symbol in one story. But the story is not heavy. As a matter of fact, most of the critics have missed most of these associations. But it seems to me very, very rich and laden with all of these associations. There's no question that Adele is correct in saying that this story is a warning about excavating in the unconscious. Because when the statue is unearthed, the count loses it. It's not the kind of guy you want to be married to. If the unaided ego is not strong enough to confront the unconscious or to mediate its energies, it is overwhelmed, as the count's is. That's dangerous, potent stuff. The powerful forces within the psyche have to be respected. They can't, however, be ignored without inviting dangerous repercussions. And, of course, what we're sensing is the count has put wraps on all of these connections to his pagan past because he can't trust himself. But that too has dangerous repercussions because when it leaks out, he's lost in obsession. There's no question that this descent is dangerous. We know that from other descent stories. But burying the Juno or closing the door to what James says in this letter to Edith Wharton, closing the door to the deeper and darker and unapparent things in which things really happen to us, that also involves a tremendous loss. So what I want to suggest to you is that when we get to the end of the story and the necessity of burying the statue, that we are also left with a sense of loss. No question about that. The statue has to be buried for day-to-day reality to continue, or else the count is lost, and the marriage is lost. But something else is lost when the statue is buried that the count was longing for. While the count worshipped the Juno, I mentioned that he kept her hand as a relic in a silver box. Hand relics were considered potent magic, capable of healing. The hand symbolizes relatedness, connection, extension into the world, manipulation, effectiveness, authority, all of those associations we have to the hand images. And years after Juno's burial, we know from this visitor who comes and asks the rude question, years after the statue is buried, the hand still remains in the Count's possession. But it's no longer in the silver box, treated like a relic. It's behind glass. And it's removed from relationship to anything of potency. It's just kind of tucked away in a corner, which is another symbolic statement about how far removed the Count is from what was carried by the statue. What I'm suggesting is that what's lost with Juno's burial, because she's put back underground, is not only the connection to what she personifies for the Count, all of that soul stuff, disruptive, creative, potentially transformative stuff. But what also is buried is the Count's chance to establish a conscious relationship to all of that. The problem with the Count is he doesn't have a very greatly developed symbolic function. When the statue's buried, there goes his chance to bring that unconscious stuff into a conscious relationship to him. He has not bridged the literal. If the statue is there, he falls into obsessive worship. If the statue is buried, he has no connection. What's missing in the Count is some kind of symbolic function to carry her with him. The relic is only a relic when the statue is there and the connection can be made in a literal way. So the Count's also weak ego, weak symbolic function, a weak transcendent function, if we want to say, stuck at the literal level. Without her presence, the statue, concretely before him, he loses touch, and he has no way to move from obsession to conscious relationship. His chance is gone. Doesn't have a good analyst. The narrator's observation that the count does not become a thoroughly modern man. So something still lingers with the Count. He hasn't quite made the transition to the modern world. Suggests that all of that picturesque faith of modern times isn't really enough to satisfy this soul-hungry guy. But on the other hand, he has nothing that allows him to release the passion that we know is there. So now I still haven't answered the question about what could be the significance between calling the statue Greek, related more to Hera, and calling her Roman, related more to Juno. Yes?
The Count says it's Roman.
Count says it's Greek. It's not Roman. That's an insult to him.
Okay. That's it.
Right.
Rational,
maybe political, functional would be the terms I'd use. Rational.
More methodical, more efficient, more empire builders.
Right, road builders.
Conquerors, not,
right.
World builders. Greeks conquered the world because they lost their
faith. The Greeks are stronger in the myth, the imagination, the story, the philosophy.
I don't see it in the Romans. I don't even know what the Romans think for that.
Bacchus.
Bacchus.
The wine god.
And Bacchus, in my mind, my memory is thinking that is less important in Roman mythology than before the Greek.
Well, and there's less of Bacchus to hold on to. They left a lot out. Right. Right. Not as full. Their gods are not as full and as rich. They're much more functional. Juno is has political function. It's in her temple that there is a mint. The coins are made in Juno's temple. She has much more of a political, civic, secular function than Hera did, connected to the great goddess. Michael?
What I was wondering, too, is I've been to Italy, and I was from the town where my parents came from Jerusalem. And I remember that they had an old temple right there where the Catholic Church later on. And
the temple was
Isis. So what I had found out was that the Europeans in that area were in Rome, but I didn't know what was in Rome. I was trying to play with it in Rome. Was that they adopted the gods and goddesses, of course they conquered, driving to the wrong and flying to them. And it was like there was no connection, and the Greeks had no connection where the old Russian Nazis, the Greeks are, say, 180 BC, it doesn't have the Greeks, it's 500 BC. And from what I understand, that they had more of a connection with the gods and goddesses. They worshiped them on a daily basis. They excluded them in their daily functions, whereas the Romans were like the politicians of today in Washington. They're really going through emotions, and they're not real. I don't find them to be in touch with any spirituality whatsoever in our country. I mean, I don't see that in our leaders. So I don't see that in our family. I don't see that in our islands. I don't see that. And I knew that this was wrong. They weren't even mentioned after the gods and goddesses in their programs.
The Romans are much more political, functional, secular, efficient in that sense. Apollonian, perhaps you'd say, Athenian. Well, but you know, the Greeks also, I mean, the Romans also fell apart. Rome fell apart because of excess. So, you know, I want to be careful with those terms that we don't put them everywhere. The Greeks personified their gods and goddesses, developed a rich literature, a rich mythology. They were at the more poetic, religious end of the spectrum, whereas the Romans are much more political, secular, organized. Romans were more practical, more politically oriented. Their deities were more functionally defined. And with these changes, it was said that the Romans wholly, the civic traditions of the Romans wholly lost their power over the hearts of men. And the commentators talk about the shift into the more political, and what's lost is the soul stuff. And that's, in a nutshell, that is the shift from more of the poetic, rich, associative literature, mythology, religion, to the more practical. And the count's affinities are with the Greeks rather than with the Romans, the older, more poetic, more soul stuff. The narrator, in describing Juno in this quotation I'm going to read you, is going to emphasize what is more the stately function of Juno, the way the Romans would think of Juno. Her beautiful head, bound with a single band, could have bent only to give the nod of command. Her eyes looked straight before her. Her mouth was implacidly grave. One hand outstretched appeared to have held a kind of imperial wand. The arm from which the other had been broken hung at her side with the most queenly majesty. So you have that imperial stature of Juno. And that's how Juno is, you know, the hand is up like this. In the Roman times, she was the protector of the community. I mentioned the mint was in her temple. Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, that's Zeus, Juno, or Zeus, Hera, and Athena, translated into the Greek, were really the principal gods of the Roman pantheon. They formed the triad that became the symbol of Rome. So she's right up there with the political powers, so to speak, among the gods and the goddesses. The older forms of Hera, and I mean pre-Homeric Hera, are associated with far fewer political, functional associations. And they point to the oldest symbols of divinity, the great goddess. Because the great goddess appeared in triple form. Hera's surnames were three, the maiden, the fulfilled, and the solitary. This is out of Kerenyi, suggesting the fullness of the ancient goddess. We can move back through the associations from Hera to the great goddess in her oldest and triple manifestations. In the Homer's Homeric legends, the Hera, the Juno that we hear about, is really the raging, jealous wife. But you have to remember that that's the patriarchal interpretation of the goddess. That's not the ancient Hera of the great goddess tradition. That's the patriarchal limitation of that goddess, turning it into raging, jealous, possessive, vengeful wife, or the shrew of Shakespeare. So what we're doing in our analysis is not only going back from Juno to Hera, but going back to the pre-Homeric Hera, and older still to her ancestor, the great goddess. And what I'm doing is pointing the count in the direction way back there to all of that great goddess stuff. I don't want to go into all the associations unless later you're interested, but Hera is also connected to Python, if you want to get back to the Dionysian thing, to the new moon, the dark time of the year. All that dark stuff is in the association to the Hera if you go back far enough. The Countess is much more closely associated to the Roman goddess or to the Homeric Hera, that is, to the woman who is fulfilled in relation to the man. Now, the old Hera didn't need the man for completion. She went to bathe once a year at the spring of Canopus, I think it's how it's pronounced, Canopus, something like that, to renew her virginity. And this is where Esther Harding talks about the virgin as the woman unto herself who doesn't need the male for completion. Those are the associations, male for completion, one unto herself. It's virgin not in the sexual sense. This is Esther Harding's work with that term. The great goddess has all, and the Hera associations are all to that complete woman unto herself, whereas the Homeric Hera and Juno are always seen in relation to the husband. Now, the Countess is much more on the modern side because she's the one who finds fulfillment in the marriage. And what's wonderful is that James plays with this. You remember the movie Yentl? And the character whose name I keep forgetting, Amy Irving played, the woman who was the perfect wife. Okay, well, the Countess is like that Amy Irving character. And her contentment was perfect when she was in the orbit of her husband. To stroll in the aisle walk, to feel her husband's arm around her waist and his shoulder against her cheek, to roll cigarettes for him while he puffed them in a great marble-paved rotunda in the center of the house, to fill his glass from an old rusty red amphora. These graceful occupations satisfied the young Countess. She's an Amy Irving character, whatever her name is. In her tinted prettiness, the blonde Countess lacks all the darker aspects of the ancient goddess. This is why I love literature so much, because you get all of these associations just to a simple contrast. Tinted blonde, you know, as opposed to dark, rich, deep Hera. She is characterized by devotion to her husband, carried to ridiculous extremes. And here's my favorite example. She would sit and brush the flies from him while he lay picturesquely snoring. It's a great story. You have to go read it in all the detail. The Countess is more closely associated with Juno as the symbol of marriage than she is with the Juno Hera, queen of heaven, sovereign unto herself. Unlike Juno, the Countess is not and does not function as a transpersonal figure, an image of the divine. This either-or dilemma that I was trying to spell out in the beginning, the Count experiences in having to choose between Juno and his wife, expresses a kind of opposition between an inner and outer, an unconscious and a collective. And this opposition at certain stages in our life, Johnson talks about in the book, we may be in deadly conflict. There may be times in which we can't handle a Juno and a wife, the deep stuff in a day-to-day reality, the artistic creation and a marriage, whatever it means to be in relationship. There are times in which those two feel like they are in conflict. Juno and the Countess both function as anima figures in the Count's life. The anima represents the principle of relatedness to one inner self. Are you all familiar with anima concept, good Jungian stuff? Okay. The collective unconscious, the unknown, the unknowable. Juno functions as an anima figure by drawing the Count away from the surface of his life, in one sense represented by the marriage. Juno comes into his life, his marriage falls apart. Juno turns the Count inward, into moodiness, entanglements with unconscious energies that drive his obsession. So you see how disturbing this Juno figure is. Juno disrupts the order of his life and lures the count into something other, deeper, darker, some other dimension of buried stuff that's also connected with the transpersonal. That, too, is a very Jungian paradigm. You go down far deep enough, you get connected to something high enough, transpersonal. The count's obsessive worship of Juno indicates that she operates autonomously within his psyche. He's not in control. He is possessed. She has overwhelmed him, taken possession of him, because he has not yet consciously established a relation to her and to all she represents. And von Franz helps us here when she says, every content of the unconscious with which one is not properly related tends to obsess one, for it gets us from behind. If you can't talk to it, you get into relationship with it. You can either be possessed by a content constellated in the unconscious, or you can have a relationship to it. The more one represses it, the more one is affected by it. This is Mary Louise von Franz's Redemption Motifs in Fairy Tales, page 103. Pardon me?
What you said was the more one affected, the more...
It gets you from behind. You've got to be able to talk to it. Right. So imagine the poor count who doesn't have a symbolic function. You know, his chance to be in connection is lost when she's buried. Now the count, so you understand how the Juno operates as an anima figure to disrupt the count's life.
Are you suggesting that Juno operates in all of the historical
In the story. I'm just talking about in the story right now.
Yeah. And then for the count, is she both ancient era?
He says the statue's Greek, not Roman. I think he's pointing us in the direction of these rich, soul-searching connections. Yes, I'm pushing us back to the oldest Hera, the great goddess. I mean, that's what I'm doing by accumulating these associations and by showing how the countess and the narrator stay more at the surface of the life. It's a good question. Do you want to? Do you have a sense of that? What we need to?
I'm not quite sure.
Well, artists do it all the time. They create art which makes that bridge. He had no way of bringing her into his life symbolically, through art, through ritual, through admiring the beauty of the statue and aesthetic appreciation. The dwarfish excavator could drink his wine and admire her beauty in the moonlight without losing it. He had none of that Italian relish of the beauty of the stone. He was lost. I mean, he admired the beauty, but he couldn't keep it at that aesthetic appreciation. He got lost in an obsessive worship. Yes, well, you missed the beginning of the story. This is wild, this stuff. You pick up this... Right, read the last of the Valerii. This is all over a statue which has a lot of meaning. The last of the Valerii. Yes, this is Count Valerio. It's the last in the line.
Is there any sculpture that we would recognize?
Oh, I could have brought another book, but I didn't. I mean, this Juno figure is sort of holding... symbols of office or scales. I mean, a very regal queen-like with a scepter in her hand. Yes, exactly. I mean, that is out of that is that's the Juno posture. That's it. That is. It's that posture. Often one hand up and one hand out, and this is. Yeah, and that's. Yes, I think so. But the torch is in Juno is sometimes the scepter of office. So it's a very queenly, regal, imperial, yes, Statue of Liberty is the right posture for that body. And there are famous Juno statues just like that. So the symbolic function that the Count doesn't have could be carried by artistic creation, by aesthetic appreciation, by ritual container. How else would we do it? By dream analysis.
When you're talking about the symbolic function, and then thinking about
This is Delacroix. This is liberty leading the people.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
That whole vision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we don't really have that image today. We have kind of a lot of old men.
Well, and as you're suggesting, as it goes through the Roman and the Romantic period, the association is much more political than it is the older religious soul-connected image. Did we pick up enough of your question about what the Count unfortunately doesn't have enough of a symbolic function operating or a strong enough ego to mediate the unconscious, and artists are often ones, or the artistic process, whatever form it takes, is often a mediating force between the deep archetypal energy and our day-to-day life. Right. Well, but we know artists who've gone crazy too, who can't hold that boundary clearly enough between all of that deep stuff and their own life, and so it's quite an ordeal to work at that level, that depth. The Countess is that force which brings him back to the daily reality, and what he sacrifices in coming back to the marriage is, as I say, some kind of connection to Juno, or some possibility of transmuting that obsessive experience into something which is able to leave him connected to the married world as well as connected to the deep unconscious. So the Countess is in that pivotal position, brings him back into day-to-day reality, but she cannot bridge for him the connection to the deeper reality that she stirred up. That's why she's in this pivotal position. But it's yet not developed in James' psyche, or it's yet not in these characters in the story to bring it off in 1874. When James visited Italy on his first trip to Europe alone, interestingly enough, he went to an Italian villa, and he writes, the head of the great Juno was thrust into the corner behind a shutter in a little, like a garden house. And my comment is that sadly, at that time, only a fragment of her remained, which is a symbolic way of mentioning in the story that only a fragment of the Juno remained in the Count's life. But it remained as a hand depotentized, hanging in a closet, not as a relic in a silver box, not with the symbolic connections carried over. It's been stripped of those connections. You see how much fun you can have as a literary critic playing with these details, hands and silver boxes and gods and goddesses. And, whoa, James's perfect minefield for all those connections. So that gives you an idea of how I work with a short story as a Jungian literary critic, how I try to take the amplification, the associations, the mythology, what I know of psychology, to bring out more of the dynamics of the story. And if you read the criticism of this story, you'll find it paled in comparison. This is not what is usually done with the story. This is being published in the proceedings of the European American Conference on Literature and Psychology, where I gave this paper last summer. And a longer version has been submitted to another journal, and it will also be in my book. So those of you who want to follow my academic career can see that this, I'm very fond of this story because it opens up so much. Now, after we take a break, what we're going to do is go to the Jolly Corner and see how Alice in that story does make these connections, which the Countess cannot make. So we're going to get a little different relation to that buried stuff. So take a break for a few minutes. We have one reader here. Good. Two readers. Okay. Let me just tell you that the Jolly Corner is intimately connected with the nightmare thematically. Although the Jolly Corner is written in 1908, we think the nightmare happened in 1910. The Jolly Corner is also related to an unfinished novel that James entitled The Sense of the Past. Thank you. And it's really these two pieces of fiction, The Sense of the Past and The Jolly Corner, that are most closely associated with the nightmare. And they're fascinating to study together. In the nightmare, of course, we have an intruder situation. In the Jolly Corner, we have a gentleman who comes back from living abroad, as James had, to his family home in New York on the Jolly Corner, to discover who he might have been had he stayed in America. So you have a man in his 50s who's been away for 33 years, coming back to his childhood home, an empty house on the Jolly Corner, literally to walk through the rooms and conjure up his alter ego, the person he might have been. Now he returns to America because he's building flats on the property where one house used to be. And the income from this property over the years is what's allowed him to live abroad. But before he does anything to this house, the childhood home, which has had, I think, three generations of his family, he wants to go back through it at night, good time for this sort of activity, and meet his alter ego. So you have a character who is going in search of that other unlived life, as opposed to that intruder forcing entry in to the inner world of the dreamer. So you see the difference there automatically. We don't have time to go into The Sense of the Past, but it's a similar dynamic of a historian who's American going to a house he inherits in London to walk through its doors and descend into his ancestral past. So he is also consciously stalking something other, which is, turns out to be quite affect-laden. The Sense of the Past is a descent novel, and it's a wonderfully rich piece of unfinished fiction, particularly if you study it along these thematic lines that I'm suggesting about the appalling other. So the underlying pattern of the nightmare and the short story is significantly different in the sense that Spencer Bryden initiates the encounter with the alter ego. It's not intruded upon. Another significant difference is in the short story we have a woman character, Alice, who is Bryden's confidant, old friend, who hung around until he came back so many years later, is an intimate friend. And she has and develops a very different attitude toward the alter ego. Now, Bryden initially seeks out this other unlived life, which gets personified in a form. And he comes to the house to kind of get in its atmosphere and finally to meet it. But before he encounters the figure, Alice encounters the figure not once but twice in her dreams. So Alice knows before he does. Very interesting statement. Something about this other figure. She comes to him in the dreams. He has to go pursue it actively in the house. She doesn't tell him what it's like, although he wants to know. She basically says, you have to go do it yourself. You have to meet this character yourself. Now, I'll tell you the the plot of the story. And then what I want to go back is look at some of the paragraphs in the story in which Bryden talks about his relationship with this other figure. Because if we watch those passages, we will see very subtle differences from the beginning to the end. And that's what makes this story a fascinating study of the relation to the shadow figure. But the plot, for a minute, is really very simple. He stalks and stalks and stalks, and late one night he finally gets really scared, and he meets this figure. He realizes it's there because doors that he thought were closed are open, or they were open, they're closed. I mean, something's in the house, he knows from other evidence. Interestingly enough, like the nightmare, the number 4 plays a large part in the Jolly Corner story. It's on the fourth room, it's on the fourth floor, it's through the fourth room, it's on the fourth night that he goes back after an absence of. So 4 is a loaded number in the story. So is the image of doors and thresholds. So is the shadow figure or the thematic issue of the ego's relation to the unconscious. Basically, he gets more and more frightened, and before he actually meets this character, he says, "I give up." In other words, he started out aggressively. The hunt metaphor, the image of the hunt, is used by James. The tension level builds. It's a story with beautiful unity of tone. The image of the hunt pervades his movement. He's like a cat in his maneuvering through the house. But the intensity of the search reaches such a pitch that he gets